This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Lectures, radio shows, and more available on demand at civilpodcast.com. I am Deepak Singh. In 1993, author Greg Mortensen stumbled into a village while he was trying to climb the world's second highest mountain in the Karakoram mountain range in Pakistan. He was welcomed by the villagers and he promised to build a school for their children. Mortensen visited Charlottesville on March 27, 2008 to talk about his book, Three Cups of Tea, part of the 14th annual Festival of the Book.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rob. And I'm going to be very brief, I hope. I'm sure most of you, all of you, are familiar with the story of Greg Mortensen as chronicled in Three Cups of Tea. It's full of great, poignant scenes, but there's a scene near the beginning of the book that I really love, and it's where Mr. Mortensen has returned to California after vowing to build a school for the people of Corfe, the people who nursed him back to health after his failed attempt to reach the summit of K2. And in California, feeling the dreams of dislocation, he retreats to a place that he considers his anchor, Berkeley Self-Storage Stall 114. In this very familiar space, he wrestles with questions that ultimately change his life. And I'm just going to read a paragraph from the book. Hanging his harness, his ropes, his crampons, carabiners, hex bolts, and Jumar cinders neatly on the hooks where they'd rested only briefly between trips for the last 5 years, these tools that had carried him across continents and up peaks, once thought unassailable by humans, seemed powerless. What tools did it take to raise money? How could he convince Americans to care about a circle of children sitting in the cold on the other side of the world, scratching at their lessons in the dirt with sticks? Well, through a lot of hard work, perseverance, and some incredible good fortune, Mr. Mortensen did and does, I think, manage to make us and countless others care about these children. As he rhetorically asks in the acknowledgments of the book, "What motivates me to do this?" The answer is simple. When I look into the eyes of the children in Pakistan and Afghanistan, I see the eyes of my own children, full of wonder, and hope that we each do our part to leave them a legacy of peace instead of the perpetual cycle of violence, war, terrorism, racism, exploitation, and bigotry that we have yet to conquer. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Greg Mortensen.
Do you have a chair? Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum, and peace be with you. And thank you so much. Before we start, I'm just going to play a little 3-minute DVD, and I think it's 3 minutes, and then we'll get started.
If you go searching the corners of the world for one place where America is winning its war on terror, you should know about this place and these girls. But the story of what happened in the little school with the new bullet holes in the walls actually began 11 years ago on a mountain.
I felt defeated after K2. I was emaciated, weak, exhausted.
Greg Mortensen had just failed to climb the world's second highest mountain when he stumbled into a remote village in northern Pakistan and saw children with no school.
When I saw those 84 children sitting in the dirt during their school lessons writing with sticks in the sand, I literally had this eureka moment.
Virtually penniless, Mortensen took 2 years to raise money for a school. But when he returned, the villagers surprised him, saying, "Before you build the school, could you build a bridge?"
I've learned that's more important to listen than to talk.
The villagers carried supplies 18 miles. More importantly, even the man in the front of that line, the Muslim mullah, had come to trust the soft-spoken American. They built the bridge, and after nearly 3 years of hard work, built the school, too.
Seeing his dedication and the personal sacrifices that he made in order to build that school just proves kind of where his heart was and how genuine and passionate he was about what he was doing.
As Mortensen began raising money and building schools in Pakistan and then Afghanistan, teaching the basics without radical doctrine, his good reputation grew, but with dangerous consequence. Once, he was kidnapped by the Taliban. Twice, angry mullahs issued supreme religious edicts, banishing him. But turns out the local commandant, seen here, had a daughter in the school. With local support, his forces imprisoned the Taliban, and all the school kids were back in class in 2 days.
If you fight terrorism, it's based in fear, but if you promote peace, it's based in hope. What they see in schools is hope.
At last count, 400 villages in the violent hills of Pakistan and Afghanistan are now asking for schools built by one American who speaks softly and carries no stick at all.
There's a saying, when your heart speaks, take good notes. I followed my heart, and I'm sure glad I did.
John Larson, NBC News, Los Angeles.
Well, I'd like to thank the Virginia Festival of Books and Robert. Where are you, Robert? So at the end, I have to find you so you can come up here and finish up. Thank you, Robert. He's the president and of the Foundation of the Humanities, and Nancy, the program director of the Virginia Festival of the Book. I don't know if Nancy's here somewhere. Thank you very much. And Susan Coleman and Cindy, and to the university here, I got to talk to some of the architecture school students, and also I'll be talking at some high school and elementary schools, and so it's such a great honor to be here. And there's many people here who are both unable to get a seat. When I first started talking after Three Cups of Tea came out, I was using my dad's, 40-year-old slide projector with duct tape on it. And my first two talks I had to do in New York in Manhattan, and of course the publisher was horrified, so they said, you have to start using the PowerPoint stuff. So we're still, 2 years later, trying to figure all the PowerPoint stuff out. I had the great privilege to grow up in Tanzania in East Africa. When I was 3 months old, my parents were from Minnesota, and they were good Midwesterners. They were in a Lutheran church, one Sunday morning in early 1958. I was 3 months old, and they heard that they needed teachers in a school, girls' school in Tanganyika. So off we went to Tanzania, where I grew up for 15 years. And it was a paradise. It was post-colonial. It was a new democracy. President Julius Nyerere had something called Uhuru na Umoja, which means freedom and oneness or togetherness. And I got to go to school with children from 24 different countries. I got to go to school with Muslims and Jews and Christians and Hindus and Sikhs and people of all faiths. And to me, that was a paradise. My father ended up founding a hospital called the Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center, and he had to raise $6 million in the 60s to get the hospital built. The first 9 years, he raised $1 million, and the 10th year, he raised another $5 million. When it came time to open the hospital in 1972, my father got up and gave a little talk, and he said that in 10 years, all the department heads of the hospital would come from Tanzania. And there was kind of a chuckle that went out, and all the Westerners afterwards scoffed at my father and said, how could you dare say such a thing and set the people up for such an unrealistic expectation? So we came back to the States. My father passed away from cancer in the mid-80s. He was in mid-40s. It was in 1980. And we got the annual report from KCMC, the hospital, 10 years later, and all the department heads were from Tanzania. There's supposed to be a picture of the book up on the screen right now, but I'll just pretend there's a picture cover of the book, okay? Three Cups of Tea. Three Cups of Tea. First cup, you're a stranger. Second cup, a guest. And third cup, you become family. And I learned that from an old village chief in Korfe Village in the northern Pakistan, Karakoram Mountains. The subtitle of the original book, Three Cups of Tea, the hardcover version, was picked by the publisher, Viking Penguin, and they told me that the subtitle of the book would be One Man's Mission to Fight Terrorism One School at a Time. And I was very opposed to that, because I say I don't do this to fight terrorism, but I do this to promote peace. And they said, no, Greg, you need to learn a couple things about the publishing industry. And I'm at a festival of books, but I'll give you some inside stuff on the publishing industry. First of all, only 12% of nonfiction books make a profit. And number two, two-thirds of all bestsellers are pre-chosen by the publisher. They said, Greg, we would like you. We want to help promote your book, but you need to be fighting terrorism so we can pitch the media. So the hardcover came out in March of 2006, but it only sold about 20,000 copies. And I had made a deal with a publisher, having worked in Pakistan for many years. I said, if the hardcover doesn't do well, I want the paperback subtitle changed to One Man's Mission to Promote Peace, One School at a Time. And so the hardcover came out. As I mentioned, it sold only about 20,000 copies. They were hoping for, you know, many more zeros on the end of that. And I was in Pakistan in December 2006. There was a new editor on the book named Paul Slavak, and he called me up. He said, we've decided to change the subtitle of Three Cups of Tea to One Man's Mission to Promote Peace, One School at a Time. And so the paperback came out January 30th last year, and it's been a New York Times bestseller ever since then for 58 weeks. And I got a call after about a month. There was no national TV, no national NPR. Only the Christian Science Monitor did an official, you know, book review. Usually you need a New York Times or LA or Boston or Chicago, you know, to do a book review on a book to really get it out there. And they said, what's going on out there? And I said, well, you know what? I don't know the answer, but I know one thing, that I think Americans, we all yearn for peace. And what's really happening is it's a grassroots kind of interest from book clubs, women's groups, synagogues, mosques, churches, veterans, AUW groups, and really that's what spurred on, you know, the book becoming such of interest in America. 2 months ago, the Pentagon bought 5,000 copies to use for counterintelligence training. And last month, I spoke to all the cadets and the staff at the U.S. Air Force Academy, and afterwards they took me over to NORAD, which is the nerve center for the U.S. military. I got to spend an afternoon with some of our top commanders in NORAD. Next week I'm going to the U.S. Naval Academy, and next month to the, I think it's in Virginia, the Army Psychological Warfare Center. And but I'm finding that, you know, everywhere I go, I find that Americans were good people, and we're very generous people, we're very compassionate people. But if you fight terrorism, it's based in fear. If you promote peace, it's based in hope. And the real enemy, whether it's in Africa or in Afghanistan or in America, the real enemy is ignorance, and it's ignorance that breeds hatred. And to overcome that hatred and ignorance, we have to have courage. We have to have compassion, and we have to have love, and all those great values that Americans have, and I think it's time that we start making that change. So finally, I was going into 11th grade. It came time to come back to America. You can go back to Africa there. There we go. We had to come back to America, and I was really excited, you know, come back to the place of 4th of July's and fireworks and Cracker Jacks and all those good baseball and all those things that we celebrate. Well, I came back to the States, and my first day at St. Paul Central High School in Minnesota, I got beat up. I was in homeroom, and the kids put a garbage can over my head, and they started pounding on it. And it was because I said I'm an African, and there was a lot of confusion about that. And you know what? It was the first time in my life that I learned about the word racism. It was the first time I learned about prejudice. And it wasn't in Africa. It was here in America. We were completely broke. So 4 days after high school, in June of 75, I did something that was not very popular at the time. I joined the U.S. Army, not only to serve my country, but to get the GI Bill, because I really wanted to go to college and get an education. It was actually in the Army where I met men and women from all across America, And I realized that our country is a great country, not because of our commonality, but because of our great diversity. In Africa, growing up, I learned a proverb as a child. If you educate a boy, you educate an individual. But if you educate a girl, you educate a community. How many of you have read Three Cups of Tea? Okay. Well, so we don't need to talk about too much here. I'm sorry, I've been doing a lot of talking, so my voice, I'm just going to do the turtle pace here, and maybe my voice won't go out tonight. Krista was my younger sister, and she was a very special girl, but it was because she suffered from severe epilepsy. But she never once complained. It used to take Krista an hour the night before school. She'd pack her bags. She'd get her lunch ready. She'd line up her clothes. I'm kind of the five-minute bed-to-bus kind of guy. You know, I'm out the door and sitting in school 10 minutes later. Well, Krista saw the baseball movie called Field of Dreams in 1992, and she was very inspired by that movie. Krista saw the baseball movie, and for her 23rd birthday, she packed her bag. She was going to go from Minneapolis to Dyersville, Iowa, to see the place where the movie was filmed. But when my mother went to wake up Krista on July 24th, 92, Krista died in her sleep from a massive seizure. It was very devastating. At the time, I was, as you say, a dirtbag climber, so I decided I'm going to pick the biggest, baddest mountain on the planet and climb it and put an amber necklace on top of K2 to honor my sister Krista. And so I went to Pakistan. There you go. And I got to the Karakoram mountain range, or Karakoram. This is the greatest consolidation of high peaks in the world. There are 64 peaks above 23,000 feet high in a 100-mile area. So next time you go down the freeway here, I don't know what was it, I-something, 64. Next time you go on I-64, clock yourself 5 miles and pretend you're going straight up, and that's how high these peaks are. Around here, though, I think the eyes are kind of a little bit curvy, so, but just clock yourself 5 miles. This is K2, the world's second highest mountain. You can put 84 Matterhorns inside of K2 to fill it up. The first attempt by the Duke of Abruzzi in 1909, he reached halfway up on the right-hand side. He was wearing hobnail boots. He had a tweed jacket, and being a gentleman, he even wore a tie. And he was eating cans of sardines. This was our motley crew of, or this is our base camp. We didn't have a lot of money, and I hope there's no outdoor retailers here, but there are two-season family camping tents from Logan, Utah on the right-hand side. They're $50 each. And there's a little green tent in the right foreground that's a French Legionnaire's tent designed for the Algerian desert in the Sahara. So here we are. I'm the third from the right. This was our group. We were a rather motley crew. The gentleman in the middle, I won't tell you where he's from, but he left after 1 week because he said there's no whiskey in Pakistan. And finally, here was an avalanche, and here's the Ark Yoki Memorial, and frostbite. Oh, you can go back one. This is the west ridge of K2. On the left-hand side is China, and on the right-hand side is Pakistan. Now, we had a Pakistan visa, but we didn't have a Chinese visa. But we didn't see any gun-toting Chinese border guards, so we did go into China a little bit, and then we worked our way back up into Pakistan. And finally, 78 days later, it was time to go home. I was weak, I was exhausted and emaciated, but most of all, I was disappointed, because when I put my hand in my pocket and felt Krista's amber necklace, I felt as if I let my sister down. The first chapter in Three Cups of Tea. Does anybody remember what the first chapter is called? It's an F word that we don't like to talk about very much in America. Failure, okay. Remember failure. Well, again, in New York they said, Greg, in America you never start a book with the word failure. It's bound to fail. And I insisted on that, you know, because we've all failed in our lives and we've all made mistakes. When I turned 16, the first thing I wanted to do was get my driver's license test. It was after the oil crisis, I think in 72. And so we had a little Honda Civic, a little tiny car, was our family car. And I totaled the car taking my driver's license test. And then in college, I had to kick we used to play football, I had to kick a 28-yard field goal We were behind 16 by 17. It was the end of the game. I just had a quick kill, like a 99% shoe-in field goal. The ball was snapped, you know, lined up. I kicked the ball, and I missed the field goal, and we lost the game. You know, we all make mistakes in our lives. Some of us burn cookies in the oven. Some of us, you might fail your tests. Some of us fail in relationships. Some of you fail in your investments. I know I was at Concordia College last week, where I had spent 2 years in college, and the president got up in front of everybody and told the whole audience, 3,000 people, that I had gotten a 1.89 GPA my first semester in college. And she didn't say that I brought up to 3.4 the next semester. When that moment happens, when we fail, remember this beautiful Persian proverb: when it is dark, you can see the stars. So here we are, motley crew. I had to walk 5 days back to the nearest village, about 58 miles. I spent 5 days wandering down the Baltoro Glacier. I was stumbling. I had to carry 90 pounds. I was really having a hard time. And finally, I got to, well, with the help of a man named Musafir, who was the first Islamic or Muslim man to befriend me, I reached a little village called Corfe. When I got to Corfe, it's a very, you know, remote village, about 340 people. As I got to the village, there was a very stout, squat, gruff man there. His name is Haji Ali. He had a silver beard, and he greeted me. First he said, "Salam alaikum, peace be with you." And then he kind of looked at me, shook his head, and he said, "Chizale." And I'm from the Midwest, so the best translation I can think of the word chizale is "what the heck." And I was very weather-beaten. My pants were ripped. You know, he hadn't a clue where I'd come from. And he said, "Welcome to our village, but son, first you need to take a bath." So I hadn't had a bath in 84 days. So he took me down to the Braldu River, very icy, silty river, washed up, and I had tea and got to become friends with him. I've learned many things over the last 15 years. I've spent about 68 months in very remote areas in Pakistan and Afghanistan. One out of three children there dies before the age of one. The female literacy rate is usually about 2 to 5%. The government will tell you 50%, but in the rural areas, it's pretty much non-existent. The women are up against really staggering odds. About half the men leave the villages to try and get jobs in the cities as dishwashers or on road construction crews. In order to get a job, often they have to pool their resources. They have to sell their goats. They have to sell their land. And who's left behind? It's the women. The women now tell me that their workload has doubled over the last 2 to 3 decades because the strong young men have left the village. Only about half the men get a job. And you ask those men, what do you do with your $400 or $500 that you get over your seasonal employment? Most of the men, it's very prestigious for them to come back to their village marching in with 40 or 50 bags of white flour. What do they grow there? They grow buckwheat, they grow barley, they grow brown wheat, very nutritious things. We also did a study in 1998. We took the hemoglobin, or the red blood cell count level, of 18 women in Corfe. Most of the women had a hemoglobin of 8 to 9. Most of the women here, your hemoglobin is 12 to 14. And if your hemoglobin was 8, you'd be in an ambulance with a siren on going to get a pint of blood. And the reason they're mostly anemic is because they don't get any protein. The men eat all the protein, the eggs, then the meat, and the women very rarely get. These are menstruating, childbearing women. Very rarely do they get the protein in their diet. So this is actually the first picture I took in Corfe in 1993. I was a stranger, and they were a stranger to me. And we had yet to have 3 cups of tea with each other. Today I can tell you the names and faces of all the people there, and I also know that 6 of them are not with us here today. So I went behind the village, and there was 84 children sitting in the dirt, 5 girls, 79 boys, and most of the kids were riding with sticks in the sand. And for those of you who are students sometime, just go outside and spend 2 minutes, take a stick, and write in the sand. Do your calculus or, you know, your composition 101. Just spend 2 minutes and see what it feels like. Because really, to understand poverty, if you want to help poverty, alleviate poverty, you have to taste poverty. You have to smell poverty. You have to feel poverty. You have to be with poverty. You have to sleep with poverty. You can't solve poverty from a think tank in Washington, D.C. So when a young girl named Chocho came up to me and she said, could you help us build a school? I made a promise that day. I said, I promise I'll build a school for you. And little did I know that that would change my life forever. Well, I came back to the States, and so I had no experience fundraising or building a school. You got to understand, I worked as a nurse, and I also was taking graduate studies in neurophysiology, but fundraising, that was something completely foreign to me. So what I did is I went to the local library. Is there any librarians out there? Okay. You're good librarians. Most librarians just kind of go like this, so I really... Everybody give a big round for the librarians here. Thank you. And I went to the librarian, and what we did is we looked up the name of 580 celebrities and movie stars and sports heroes and philanthropic type of people. I didn't know how to use a computer, so over 10 weeks I started hand typing 580 letters. Dear Michael Jordan. Dear Sylvester Stallone. And I won't give you the rest of the list. A lot of people ask me about that list, but I'm keeping it confidential. And guess what happened? Nothing happened. Then around Christmas time, I got one check back from Tom Brokaw, the newscaster, for $100. And it said, good luck, Greg. Recently, Tom Brokaw moved to Montana and invited us to his ranch for dinner. This is about last November. And I was very honored to go there. He wrote a blurb on the front of Three Cups of Tea that's really helped promote the book. But he also has been kind of avoiding me lately. So I asked him, I said, Tom, how come you're avoiding me lately? He said, well, actually, Greg, I'm really embarrassed because a lot of people have come up to me and asked me about this Three Cups of Tea thing, and I only wrote you a $100 check. Now, I didn't have the guts to say, you know, you can still write a bigger check. What I told Tom is I said, you know, I'm so grateful for that because you inspired hundreds of other people to write a $100 or $101 check, so I really thank you. Now, to add insult to the injury, my daughter Amira is 11. She's in sixth grade, and we were doing homework after, this is about last November also, and I noticed she was kind of distracted, and then she looked up at me and she said, Daddy, I figured out that in 93 you used $112 for postage and you only raised $100. Well, by springtime, then I sold my car. I had an old Buick that I inherited from my grandfather for $500. I sold my climbing gear. I sold all my old mountaineering books, you know, everything pretty much. But by springtime, I'd only raised $2,400. And my mother, who's a principal at Westside Elementary School, she invited me to come and talk to the kids there for 2 days. It's in River Falls, Wisconsin. And I was very inspired. When I got ready to leave, a fourth grader came up to me. His name was Jeffrey. And I just recently talked to Jeffrey. He's now quite a guy, but at the time he was in fourth grade. He looked at me deadpan. He said, I've got a piggy bank at home, and I'm going to help you build that school in Pakistan. And I didn't think anything of it. And 6 weeks later, Westside School had raised 62,340 pennies. And when you think about it, it wasn't celebrities, it wasn't movie stars, it wasn't our sports heroes, it wasn't even adults, but it was children in their innocence and purity reaching out to children halfway around the world. And they did it with their pennies. So what can you buy with a penny in Charlottesville? Maybe half a gumball or something. But in Pakistan and Afghanistan, in Africa, you can buy a pencil. It's not that a pencil is so important, but what education does, though, is it gives a child hope. I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts in January, and a guy there, an economist, told me that there's enough pennies. I don't know how he figured this out, but he told me there's enough pennies in houses in America that we could eradicate global illiteracy three times over if we used all those pennies up. And roughly what it cost is there are today in the world 145 million children deprived of education aged 5 to 15 due to slavery, poverty, gender discrimination, racial discrimination, wars, you know, corrupt governments, all kinds of things. If we wanted to eradicate global literacy, which is part of the 2000 UN Millennium Goals, it would only cost $6 billion per year for 15 years. That ends up being about $1 to $2 per month per child. Unfortunately, that really hasn't happened. What's happened with our Pennies for Peace now, it's in about 700 schools. There's a whole curriculum to it, but one of the components, they've even gotten political with it. 20 years ago, the U.S. signed an agreement with about 20 other countries. We said that we would give 1% of GDP to foreign aid to help eradicate poverty and, you know, illiteracy. Only Norway and Sweden, I think Denmark, have actually done that. The U.S., we're about number 16 on the list, and last year was the highest year ever. We gave 0.17% of GDP to foreign aid. That's 1/6 of one penny per dollar to foreign aid. Now, you have to appreciate that Americans, we are the most generous people on the world. We give more per capita in the private sector than most countries. But I think if our government sign an agreement and a mandate that we give 1% of GDP, that we should do that. And so the kids, we've had tens of thousands of letters go up to Capitol Hill and say that when they grow up, they're going to give 1% of GDP and that one penny per dollar to really make a difference in the world. And a lot of senators have been calling our office now. They're being bombarded with pennies on Capitol Hill, but I think it's the message is getting there. So finally, I went back to Pakistan, I got the school supplies, went up the Karakoram Highway, and I got back to Corfe. And I got to Corfe, there's no phone, no postal system, no email there, so they're really surprised. And then Haji Ali again greeted me. First he said, Salaam Alaikum, and then again, Cheezalay. And because he didn't think I was coming back, and he was very surprised. He said, you know, We didn't think you're coming back, but if you really want to build a school first, we're going to have to build a bridge first. So I hadn't thought about that. So I had to come back to America. I had to raise $10,000 more. I went back in 95, and in 10 weeks, they built a 284-foot span bridge over the Brawler River. There are 5 800-pound steel cables holding that bridge together that they carried 18 miles on big spools up the mountain trails to get this bridge built. September 13th, 1995, I was 38 years old. I was a pretty diehard bachelor. And I was at a fundraising dinner in San Francisco where my childhood hero, Sir Edmund Hillary, was speaking. And it was getting kind of late, and I'd like to also acknowledge Sir Ed. He did some amazing things. He inspired, you know, he's gotten thousands of kids going to school in the Himalaya, and he's done a lot of good work. He's the first guy who climbed Everest. We also, unfortunately, passed away this year. And so I'd like to thank Sir Ed for what he did and for inspiring so many people to really make a difference. But Sir Ed also was going on and on about the Queen's coronation in 1953. So I finally went to the back. There was a beautiful woman in a dress wearing black combat boots. And I started talking to her. Her name was Tara. And 6 days later, we got married. And we're living happily ever after in Montana now with our two kids. I was at Camp Pendleton, the U.S. Marine Corps base in Oceanside about 3 weeks ago. There was 2,000, I spoke to 2,000 U.S. Marines who were about to be deployed to Afghanistan. And I told the black combat boot story, and the commandant afterwards, he came up to me and said, you know, you should be talking to my men and women about this right before they go to Afghanistan. So finally, and I'm going to get back to the Marines in a second here. So we started working on the school. It was very tedious. I wasn't getting very far. I was making a lot of mistakes. We also had a lot of physical obstacles. The road kept washing out in this place called Chakpo Canyon, which is 18 miles from Corfe. So the men had to keep carrying the loads up to the village. And you can see 3 years later, we hadn't gotten very far. And the actual problem, it wasn't them. The problem was me. I was doing something that we call micromanagement. I had my plumb line receipts and records, and I was determined I would get this school built. Well, one day, Haji Ali, you can see him in the back there with a silver beard, he came up to me and he said, we're grateful to Allah for your help, but you need to do one thing. You need to sit down and be quiet and let us do the work. And he took my receipt, my plumb line records, and he locked them up in his little earthen locker along with his holy Quran and his prayer beads and his shank of ibex meat. And he came back and he said, there, everything will be just fine. Don't you worry. And he added the word, inshallah, Allah willing. Of course, I was horrified. And guess what happened in 2 months? the school got built. And it was an important lesson I had to let go, let the communities be empowered, and also learn to listen to Haji Ali and his words of wisdom. When I go to schools in America, one of the questions I ask students, and this is like kindergarten all the way through university students, is how many of you have talked in great detail to your grandparents or your elders about the Depression or the Vietnam War or the Civil Rights Movement or World War II or maybe the Vietnam War, or perhaps when your great-grandparents came from a distant land and settled in America? Unfortunately, in America, only about 10% of the hands come up, very consistent. If you ask that same question in Pakistan or Afghanistan or in Africa, 90% of the hands or 80% of the hands will come up. And I think it's a great tragedy that in our country we don't learn from our elders, and the responsibility is both on the younger generation and the older generation. So one thing we do in all our schools is two or three times a week we have the elders come in and teach the children about their folklore, their culture, and their heritage. It's the kids' favorite class in school. I'm hoping that maybe some American school someday will start to do that. Now, this is a micro scale, but you could also apply this on the macro scale. One of my main criticisms, or you say suggestions, of the reconstruction in Afghanistan is that right now it's centralized and deprovincialized. If you look back in history at the Marshall Plan, some of you might remember the Marshall Plan after World War II, it was a brilliant plan. And the architects who designed it were genius, but the main component of the Marshall Plan was that it was provincialized and decentralized. Now, we've completely flipped that around in Afghanistan. Right now, actually, it's going, you know, more provincial, but for 6 years, that didn't really happen. And sometimes I wonder why, when something really works in history, when people are really empowered to make a difference themselves and you put responsibility on people, you know, why we can't learn and glean from our history. And I think part of that is not really listening to our forefathers and elders and foremothers. Well, I decided in 96 I'd dedicate my life to building schools and helping girls and boys go to school halfway around the world. And the first thing that happened to me is I had a fatwa issued against me. And I've had two fatwas issued against me, one by a Sunni imam and one by a Shia imam. And the first fatwa was banishing me from the country because I was helping girls go to school. So I sought out the advice of Syed Abbas Rizvi. He's the head Shiite imam in northern Pakistan. He's a very powerful man, but also a very visionary and compassionate man. So he said, I said, you know, whatever you decide, I'll respect your decision. So several months later, I was summoned into the inner sanctum of the Imam Bara Mosque in Skardu. It was very imposing. You can see on his head he has a black turban, meaning he is descended of Muhammad, the prophet. And I thought that was it, I'm going to get booted out of the country. But instead he brought me a red velvet box, and he opened it. And then it was a letter written in the ornate Farsi or Persian script. And it read, Bismillah al-Rahman al-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Merciful, the Beneficial. We have reviewed your case, and in our Holy Quran, education is encouraged for all children. And furthermore, what this man is doing in your midst is in the highest principles of Islam. So we give our blessings and our approval. I've also learned many things from Syed Abbas and some of the other imams. In the revelation, in the Quran, the first word of the revelation to Muhammad the prophet is the Arabic word Iqra. And Iqra means read. The first two chapters of the revelation in the Quran implore that all people have a quest for knowledge and seek the truth, meaning educate everybody, and this goes beyond Islam. So why is educating girls so important? Of course, we have to educate the boys, but if we don't educate the girls, nothing's going to change. My quote is, we can drop bombs, we can hand out condoms, you can build roads, or you can put in electricity, but unless the girls are educated, a society won't change. Of those 145 million children on school today, 89 million are female. If you educate a girl, if you go, you know, University of Virginia and look up some stuff about it, this is what you'll find. If you educate a girl to at least a fifth grade level, it does three important things. One, reduce infant mortality. Number two, reduce the population explosion. And number three, improve the basic quality of health and of life itself. The number two point there, there's a very incredible model of that. In Bangladesh, which is sometimes chided as a very backward country, or I've heard it called even the armpit of Asia, but Bangladesh has actually had an incredible transformation happen in the last 30 years. In 1970, the female literacy rate was around 20%. They launched a national initiative to get every single girl and female educated in Bangladesh. Today, the female literacy rate is around 70%. And if you look at a population demographic curve, you can see the population in Bangladesh is just now starting to reach an apex, about 2.4 births, live births per female. Pakistan, on the other hand, the female literacy rate might be 30 or 35%. The population in Pakistan is going to double in the next 26 years from 160 million to 320 million people unless something is really done. And the key to that, I think, is female literacy and girls' education. If you study the Quran also, there's something more. You know, when the hardcover came out and said, one man's mission to fight terrorism one school at a time, so I had to figure out, you know, how do you fight terrorism with education? And obviously, you can do that. One thing and point that we use, even in discussing this with some, you know, resistant or despot mullahs, is in the Quran, when a young man goes on jihad, it's very implicitly spelled out that he first has to get permission and blessings from his mother. And if he doesn't do that, it's very shameful or disgraceful. After 9/11, the Taliban had a high desertion rate. This is before the U.S. and coalition went into Afghanistan. But the Taliban were mainly targeting, they were going around at gunpoint to get recruits, but mainly targeting illiterate, impoverished society because educated women were refusing to allow their sons to go on jihad. And a further validation of that is that in our schools today, we have 540 teachers, but four of them are previous Taliban, and two of them were hardcore Taliban. The reason all of them changed around, and it's kind of like an ex-smoker, you know, they get really against, and they're totally our biggest advocates for girls' education. But the reason all of them changed around is because their mothers told them that what you're doing is not in the name of Islam, so they decided they would quit, you know, being in the Taliban. And it's remarkable to see their passion now and dedication to really promote girls' education. Okay, I have some good news and I have some bad news. So I'm being that this is a election year, I'll let you decide. Do you want to hear the good news first or the bad news? Bad news. Okay, you can go forward once. The bad news is that in Afghanistan today, in the last year, about 16 months, about 450 girls' schools have been bombed or destroyed or shut down by the Taliban. Well, most of them are girls' schools. There's a few boys' schools. What's interesting, though, is why would the Taliban or jihadis attack girls' schools and not boys' schools? And I think it is because the greatest fear is not the bullet, but it's the pen. And even more than that, they fear that when that young girl grows up and she becomes a mother and she has an education, the value of education will go on in the community. The good news... Can you go back? All right, go back one. The good news is, I'll paraphrase a little bit. Over the last maybe 16 months, I've been in about 150 cities, and I've talked to over 100,000 people, and I ask this question everywhere I go. So I'm going to ask you tonight the same question. How many of you know the fact that in Afghanistan today, there are 5.5 million children going to school, 1.8 million are female, and in 2000, there were only 800,000 kids in school. Are any of you aware of that fact? Let's see. Let me step out here so I can see. Okay. Nobody here. Okay. Have you heard me say that before? Or did you find it somewhere else? Okay. Okay, good. Did you hear what she said? Okay. She said she's been reading about Afghanistan long before they bombed the Buddha and before 9/11 and when the women were working for bread in Kabul. So I've asked this question, maybe 100 or now probably 120,000 people. Only 35 hands have come up in total. Now, to me, that's the single most inspiring, credible news to come out of that country, and nobody in America is aware of it. The media, the government, you can go to think tanks, the people. And to me, that's the kind of news that people should know about. When I was at Camp Pendleton, speaking to those 2,000 Marines, hundreds of them came up to me afterwards and said, "We're so glad you told us that one thing, because that alone gives us, you know, hope and courage." And also, you know, they were so happy to hear that news. And that's the kind of news I think that should be broadcast from every mountaintop and hilltop in this country. Thanks. So this is Aziza, and Aziza is from Charpersen. It's a tribal area on the Afghan border. Aziza is the first girl out of 4,000 females or 4,000 people in her valley to get an education, and it wasn't easy. In first and second grade, the boys used to throw stones at her because she went to school. In third and fourth grade, her teachers refused to teach her because she was female. When she got to high school, those boys stole her notebooks because they didn't want her to graduate. But guess what happened? Aziza graduated, and she became a maternal health care worker. She delivers babies and does pre- and postnatal care. Before Aziza started working in 2000, she came back to her valley. There's no medicine, no doctor, no clinic in the whole valley. 5 to 20 women died in childbirth every single year in the valley. So Aziza went to 2 years of training. It cost about $800. She gets paid just over $1 per day. Since 2000, not one single woman has died in childbirth in Charpersen Valley. It's been interesting and also fascinating and also a blessing over the last year. I've been able to go to the Pentagon and Capitol Hill, and I've been at Republican prayer breakfasts. I've been at anti-war feminist meetings in the Bay Area. I've been, you know, military places and in universities. And also, I get a lot of emails and letters, and I get dozens of emails from people in the U.S. military in Afghanistan. With pretty much without exception, they all say one thing: without education, nothing will really change in Afghanistan. And I'd like to share with you one email I got from, his name is Colonel Kalenda. He's from Maryland. He has 4 children. He's just like any of us. He's the commander of the forward operating base in Nari, in eastern, it's in Kunar province in Afghanistan. He's over there right now until December. It's one of the most difficult, dangerous posts you could have in Afghanistan. And this is an email he'd like to share. Now, he's given me permission, along with the Department of Defense, to share this in public, but here's his email. You can go ahead. I'll just paraphrase a little bit. He says, "I'm the commander of the Task Force Sabre," and he's working in Kunar, Nuristan province. "Our primary goal in this counterinsurgency is to provide hope for the good people of Afghanistan. Building schools is one of my top development priorities. I am convinced that the long-term solution to terrorism in Afghanistan is education. The conflict here will not be one with bombs, but with ideas that excite the imagination towards peace, tolerance, and prosperity. People are tired of war after 30 years. Education will make the difference whether the next generation grows up to be educated patriots or illiterate fighters. The stakes could not be higher." And he can't share this with people in our government. He can share maybe with the military, but, you know, just on behalf of him, on behalf of Saeed Abbas, who says the Quran advocates education, on behalf of villages, on behalf of girls whose lives are threatened to go to school, I'd ask that, you know, all of us could support these young children and communities in their endeavor to have light through education. So remember what Colonel Kalenda said: the stakes could not be higher. We'll jump across the border into Pakistan. There was a massive earthquake in October 2005. These are the statistics: 74,000 people killed, 18,000 were kids going to school. It happened at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning. Most of the kids who died, they didn't have desks, so when the roof came down, it killed those kids. And most of them were children, younger, and they were female because they didn't have desks. What's really, to me, most disturbing or tragic is that 500,000 children were displaced out of school. 9,000 schools destroyed or shut down. And as of today, now in 2008, I got to adjust this, but 450 schools only have been rebuilt. And at first, there was a heroic effort. All of Pakistan, the international community, helped. The U.S. military even sent in 24 C-47 Chinook helicopters. They conducted the greatest helicopter airlift in the history of mankind, and for that the people were grateful. What happened within a year later, though, is that the aid dropped 80%. In the wake of that, many jihadi or U.S.-labeled terrorist organizations have set up refugee camps. This is the Jamaat Islamiyat camp. It's a U.S.-labeled terrorist organization. If you look at that photo in the back, you can see on the right-hand side is a mess tent, and on the left-hand side is an extremist madrasa where the kids are getting indoctrinated in a very violent type of Islam. Previously, they were going to school. Now this is what's happening. 2 miles down the road from this is the Al Rashid Trust. It's run by Dr. Aziz Amir, who is Osama bin Laden's personal previous physician. He's a British-trained orthopedic surgeon who spent 2 years in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. And until last year, 5 miles from here, was a U.S. 212 MASH unit. Now, they were all trying to help the people, but in these camps, they have another agenda. And some people say, why don't they just shut the camps down? And when I shared this photo on Capitol Hill last fall, they said, Greg, this photo should be classified and you shouldn't be showing this in public. But I think it should be the other way around. You know, I don't understand why the Pakistan government, the international community, we cannot provide about $1 or $2 per month per child to help those kids go on with school. And if we went and set up a school in that camp, the IRS would shut us down overnight because we'd be affiliating with a terrorist organization. You know, think of the irony of that. And we don't have money for all the schools we'd like to build, so we use whatever we can. This is in Maidan Shah in Afghanistan. This is a Soviet armored personnel carrier. It's a ninth grade class. There's 12 students inside. If you want to take a look inside, there they are learning English. You can go back one. And 80 second graders going to school in a steel truck container. This was used to bring over U.S. military supplies. We've converted this into a classroom. And where are the girls? They're outside going to school in the dirt. But they're still very resilient and trying to get their education. And I'm often asked, and some people are very critical, they say, you know, how could you desert your wife and go overseas and do this dangerous work? But I do have the support and blessings of my family and my wife. And that, to me, that's also the most difficult part about my job, because for half the year, I'm not with my family in Montana, and I didn't get to see my kids learn how to tie their shoes or learn how to walk or ride a bicycle. But I was there for one very precious moment in January 2006. I was with my son, Khyber, who was 5 at the time, and I had just come back from the earthquake in Pakistan, and we were reading bedtime stories. And all of a sudden, he started reading. And, you know, in celebration of literacy, I can't tell you how precious that moment was. And those of you who are parents, you remember when your child first started to read and how incredible that was. And it was such a blessing to see Khyber start to read on his own. I bring my family sometimes to Pakistan. And last August, we were in Pakistan and we inaugurated Chunda Girls' School. This school is in a very conservative area. It took us 8 years to convince the mullah there to open up a girls' school. Finally, last fall, we opened the school. My daughter and my son got to cut the ribbon. There were 74 girls in school in Chunda. School just started 2 weeks ago. After the winter break, there are 342 girls going to school now in Chunda Village. And I don't have any agenda, no political, religious, or no Western agenda. What I really try to do, though, is listen to the people and to the mothers and the parents and the communities. And I ask many elderly women, what do you want most in life? I'm here to help you, and I'm your servant, so what would you like? And you think women would tell you, I want a good husband, or I want a good house, or I want prosperity. But the two things that the women tell me in very rural areas are, number one, we want our kids to go to school, and number two, we don't want our babies to die. Those are the two things that they tell me. And the real answer to that, I think, starts with female literacy and girls' education. When I get all done here, too, I can do like a two-minute football. Some of you want to know about the current situation in Pakistan or Afghanistan. So when I get all done here, we'll do like a two- or three-minute football drill, and I'll kind of give you my thoughts on perspective on what's happening over there. So this is Sakina, and it's Haji Ali's wife. And when I got to Corfe in early 2001, Sakina had passed away, and Haji Ali was very sad. We walked over to her grave. She was buried in a box facing the west towards the sunset. And he said in a rare moment of sentiment, "Without her, I am nothing." And then he said something that I never forget. He said, "Very soon, you'll be standing here, and I'm going to be in the ground." And he kind of chuckled. And I didn't think it was very funny because, you know, I lost my sister and my husband, my father. And you know, all of us here, we've lost somebody who's very dear to us, and you never get over that. And he said, "When that moment happens, you'll be very sad. But I want you to do one thing. I want you to listen to the wind. Flung hunawet, listen to the wind." So I got back to Corfe in October 2001, and I was in Pakistan 3 months before and after 9/11. And after 9/11, everywhere I went, I was touched by the outpouring of hospitality. I remember a very poor, elderly widow named Hawa. She brought me 5 precious eggs on September 14th, 2001. She pressed them in my palms, and she said, "Please bring these to the widows in New York who are suffering, and I'm sorry that I have nothing else to share with them." I was invited for prayers of peace, and I was so touched by what I saw and felt. People came up to me and apologized for what happened in New York, even though they had nothing to do with it. Finally, it came time to go back home. I flew into Denver Airport, and those of you who've been in Denver, you come up the concourse, and it's kind of big open area, and there's all these American flags everywhere. And I called my wife, and I said, "What's going on? It looks like the 4th of July here." And she told me, "You know, you've come back to a changed country." And you have to understand, I was in a very remote area when this all happened. And so then I went home to Montana, and I started opening up all the letters I'd gotten in my absence. And I started getting hate mail. And subsequently, I got death threats. And it wasn't from people in Afghanistan or Pakistan. It was from Americans. People called me a traitor. Some people said, "I should die a painful death. I'm worse than the enemy because I'm one of us helping Muslim children go to school." And it was the only time in my whole life, I'm kind of a stubborn old Norwegian guy, but it was the only time in my life I thought about quitting my work, because if I'm in Pakistan and somebody's threatening my family in Montana, I want to go back and protect my wife and my children. It was my wife, Tara. She said, "You know, this is a merely mandate for you to get out in public and talk about what you're doing." And I'm kind of a shy, quiet guy, and it kind of horrifies me. Now it's not so bad, but in the beginning, to go out and talk about this and people are threatening me. But I did that, and everywhere I went, I met good American people, and I realized that we're also good people, and the people in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Africa, we're all good people. And I think we all yearn for peace. And so I feel so grateful to my wife, Tara, who's really encouraged me, and communities and people. And I'm learning that I think, you know, with the Three Cups of Tea book, why it's really selling so well is because, not because it's an incredible book. We made some mistakes in the book, and the writing may be not so good, but what it is about a message of hope, and I think really that's what we yearn for in our country. It's the same thing people in Afghanistan and Pakistan yearn for. So back to Haji Ali. I got to his grave. I was standing there, and I was very sad, just as he predicted. And then I remembered what he said. He said to listen to the wind. And so I did that, and I heard the voices of the children in the school. And I realized that his legacy and his vision had come true through the education of his children. And I also thought back to those very precious moments when I'd sit by his side in the evening on a little charfois, kind of little bed, and he'd read the Holy Quran or Persian poetry, a little lantern or a candle. And I noticed sometimes that he had a tear in his eye. And so finally, I asked Hajia one day, "Why are you sad when you read the Holy Quran or poetry?" He said, "Greg, I actually don't know how to read, and I memorized these books. It's my life's greatest sadness that I don't know how to read. And my life's greatest hope is that my children can learn to read and write. As I stood there, I realized also that I had come full circle, because I hadn't found the field of dreams in a cornfield in Iowa, and I hadn't found the field of dreams on top of a big bad mountain called K2, but I had found the field of dreams in a little dusty village in a place called Corfe in Pakistan. Thank you.
This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Lectures, radio shows, and more available on demand at civilpodcast.com.